Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Patricia Williams. She's a stand-up comedian, and among other things, and she's also got her memoir, Rabbit. It's now out in paperback. She recounts the story of her upbringing in inner-city Atlanta in the ghetto in the 80s and 90s, living in poverty with her alcoholic single mother with five kids, and eventually her rise out of that world into the world she now knows, a successful comic with a husband and four children living in Indianapolis in a six-bedroom house overlooking a pond with ducks. It's quite a journey through this book. Patricia, it seems your earliest memory is living with your granddaddy, who you describe as the only black man you've known who's never been broke a day in his life. What was the situation like living in his illegal moonshine liquor house?
Oh, God, it was chaotic every day. It was like, my house was like a bar. So people was there all day, every day. It was always something going on. If it wasn't gambling, it was a fight. And a lot of time I escaped it by watching wrestling with my granddaddy.
Now, he would watch wrestling on TV. People knew not to bother him, right?
Oh, yeah, my granddaddy was a badass. People knew to keep it down when granddad was watching the news and when he was watching wrestling. So it was like I saw everything that kids wasn't supposed to see.
So, you know, you're in this house, and the things that you describe in the book, you'd wake up in the morning and there'd be people passed out in the different rooms of the house, and that's where your career as a pickpocket started. Can you kind of describe how that came to be?
That was my very first job. I think I was about 5 or 6, maybe. And when the guys were passed out on the weekend, my mama woke me up one time, and she was like, get his wallet. For every wallet you steal, I give you a dollar. Well, that's a lot of money. I thought it was 8, I think. That's a lot of money. So even though I didn't understand why she had me do it, and it was very scary because, you know, people can wake up and you're in their pocket and hit you. But it ended up being not a bad gig. And I was thinking as a kid, well, maybe if I do this for her, these people would stop coming to our house. No, they just kept coming back. And every weekend, I was going in their pockets, stealing their money. Until I told my mom I was watching Sesame Street one day, and it's in the book. I said, hey, I quit unless you give me 10%. And neither one of us knew what 10% was, so she started giving me $10 a wallet.
Well, speaking of television, you talked about how Leave It to Beaver was the show that you idolized, or at least that was your fantasy world. Can you describe what it was like as a kid to see that world on TV versus the world you knew from your own life?
There was so much going on in our house, and when I would watch Leave It to Beaver, I'm like, why don't they have drunk people laying around their house? And Mom was so nice. She cooked every day. She helped with homework. And I, you know, as a kid, I was like, why don't my mama act like this lady? With the pearls around her neck, and she's never yelling. And I was like, I just want to live with her, not knowing that it wasn't real.
Eventually, you got out of the liquor house, the bootleg liquor house, and, you know, you guys moved from series of places to places. But one thing that stuck out to me, and you've talked about it in the book, is that how big of a thing hunger is. And that was probably the thing that I took from it most. That was the most difficult thing for you from growing up poor, is the hunger all the time, right?
Oh my God, all the time. You know, people don't realize how serious, you know, it is. I mean, that's one thing that's very passionate to me is free lunch. Excuse me. Because I tell people all the time, without free lunch, a lot of times I would have never ate. You know, don't punish the kids for being born into a bad situation. I mean, me and my brothers and sisters on the weekend struggle because my mother would be drunk or we just didn't have food. You know, we went to school mainly to eat. And like I tell people, I said, I don't know if you've ever been to the bottom like I've been to the bottom. But that is a pain that you don't want to have when you don't have food to put in your body. It's an indescribable pain. It's almost like labor pain. I can describe labor pain, but you don't know what it really feels like, you know, because you can't have a baby.
And even back then, the school that you went to didn't get your hunger. You talked about being in the cloakroom of the classroom and eating part of a little girl's lunch, and they punished you, even though they just didn't know you were hungry, right?
Well, Mom, yeah. The thing, I was raised, what goes on in my house stays in my house. So if I went to the school and told the teacher I was hungry, my mom would have beat the crap out of me. So, you know, I got there one morning, and I ate somebody lunch. And back in those days, the principal could whoop you. And he paddled me. And, you know, when I remember that, I said, if only he had asked me, why were you stealing? I would have said, I'm hungry. But nobody asked me. Instead, I got a whooping for eating another child lunch.
And then the thing that has the image in my mind from your childhood is ketchup sandwiches. Can you describe what those were?
It's two pieces of cheap Wonder Bread with watery ketchup in the middle, either a sugar sandwich. Take two pieces of bread and put sugar on it. And that's what we ate a lot of times, a mayonnaise sandwiches.
So you were getting government assistance, your mom was, and things like that, but, you know, the money was gone about halfway through the month. And tell me about this whole idea of your mom grilling on the front lawn of the house that you were living in at the time.
Well, she was a single parent. My mother could not afford rent with five kids, and she didn't receive child support. So we really never had gas growing up. You know, she kept the lights on. We bought our water for a bath. But, you know, she couldn't afford lights and gas. So she decided, I got to feed my kids. And she just made a grill on the outside. When this happened, actually our lights was off, too. So she put the barbecue grill out front of the house, put wood in it, and started frying chicken on it.
And
a lot of days, that's how she cooked.
When, and you talked about how the embarrassment of that was, you wait until the middle of the month because the money was gone, and because you were so embarrassed, people would make fun of you, right?
Yeah, well, a lot. The embarrassment came from cooking on a grill because my house was close to the school, and they was like, why Patricia mom out there frying chicken on the barbecue grill? Because those kids wasn't struggling like us. So it was a big embarrassment.
All right, we're talking with Patricia Williams about her memoir, Rabbit. It is available now wherever your fine books are sold. By the way, if you're wondering, Rabbit is a nickname she was given because she was eating a carrot on the front porch one day. So that answers that quick question. But Patricia, as we get into this, you had suffered sexual abuse at the hands of a neighborhood fellow that was kind of seeing your mom. And, you know, so can you take me through, this was something you didn't reveal until the book. So what's the therapy like when you write about something that happened that long ago? I got to think it's still vivid in your mind, right?
Yes, and I had never told anybody. And, you know, I had a co-writer by the name of Janine Amber. And when she asked, when I wanted to tell her, I said, let me just make sure I didn't make this up. Because I had blocked it out for so many years. Because it's not, you know, I didn't want to dwell on it. I called my sister up, and all I said was, do you remember what Mr. John did to us? And she said, yeah. And I had the co-writer on the phone, and I was like, I'm ready to tell. And so I just went through, you know, what my mama boyfriend did to us and how she ignored it. And each time he did it, it was always, you know, he would say, well, I'm helping your mother. And I didn't want to go hungry. So I felt like if I did this, if we didn't tell or if we allow him to do this to us, we would never have to be hungry. And we wasn't hungry because he always put food in the house. He helped my mama pay her bills.
And so he would hold that over your head, right, that he'd quit paying bills and bringing you guys food if you didn't perform for him, right?
Yeah.
All right. Yes. So, you know, you're 15 years old. By this time, you have two children, and you end up, this is in the time of the crack epidemic, and so you start selling drugs. Can you kind of take me through, did you understand the gravity of that situation at the time, or was that simply a survival tactic for you?
It was strictly a survival tactic. You know, I got pregnant at 13, gave birth at 14, had another baby by this married man at 15. So, I mean, I didn't even have Pampers. All I could do was wrap my baby in a T-shirt sometime. And I was like, I got to do something. So crack hit the black community, and I just got into selling drugs. You know, I remember making my first $1,000. I thought I was rich. And I was like, well, at least my kids don't have to, you know, ever be hungry. At least my kids don't ever have to go through this. I didn't think about I was going to jail. I didn't think about I could be shot. All I was thinking about taking care of those two babies that I had that I was getting no help with. I couldn't get a job. I needed a work permit. I was 15 years old.
And so you ended up getting shot and going to jail. Can you kind of take me through the time in Fulton County when your babies are on the outside and you're on the inside?
I get locked up. I get a year. And my daughter go to kindergarten. I have to leave her with one of my kids' father friends. And I remember sitting there realizing my life had went so fast my whole life. The only time my life ever slowed down is when I was doing time in jail. And I started to realize I was giving my kids what my mother had given me. And I was like, I got to break this cycle. My kids are going to be eighth grade dropout, teenage mom, convicted felons. And I miss my daughter going to kindergarten. And me and my daughter, I told our relationship apart. Because she felt, she was taught in school not to do drugs and not to do this, but her mother was doing everything the school was telling her not to do. And, she missed kindergarten, and this kid couldn't talk to me. Literally, my daughter used to write me letters like, why do you have to sell drugs? Why do you have to do this? And, I sold drugs in front of her school. How do you explain to a five-year-old you're doing it to take care of her and her mother is only 17 or 16? A five-year-old can't understand that.
Did that
whatever our age difference is, I can't really remember. But, she would not open her mouth to me for years. She just wrote me letters. She's like, we're going to get killed down here. Why daddy beat you and stuff like that.
So you've got this experience that's going on in your life, and it's a cycle, as you say, that went from your mother to you. Did going through that, in a way, kind of explain to you what your mother was going through just to provide for you kids?
Yes. I realized when I wrote this book, what my mother was looking for was love. I realized that my grandmother probably handed my mother what she was handed. And over the years, I learned to forgive my mother, but now I know why. She didn't know it. She didn't know any better. My father beat her. Every relationship she had was bad. So, that she just gave up. My mama taught me as a kid, she said, if a man don't hit you, he don't love you. So the first time my kid's father blacked my eye, I was like, oh, my God, he loved me. Oh, my God, he loved me. But after so many black eyes, I was like, if this is love, I can do without it.
So, the story ends. There's a lot in between, but you've got two daughters. You've got two other children with your husband now, and you called your first two children your Medicaid kids and your second two children, your Blue Cross Blue Shield kids. You've said that, but which I think is a funny line. But tell me about your stand-up comedy career. You got into stand-up comedy because with all these type of stories, there's a couple places you can go. You can go to clinical therapy or you can go to stand-up comedy, and you choose the latter, right?
Yes. Comedy healed me so much. I was able to tell stories in this book I never told. And then I meet so many people that have went through some of the things that I've been through or just have gone through things in life. All of us got a story. And, people tell me all the time, by you telling your story, it makes them want to talk about what they went through. So comedy was such a healing method for me.
When you write a book like this with all these personal stories about your upbringing and the things that you've gone through in your life, from an editing standpoint, does your editor have to verify all of these stories? I know I've talked to David Sedaris before, and he tells me when he writes his books, they go through and contact everybody he mentions to make sure the stories add up. How did that work for this book?
Oh, we called everybody. I called old drug dealers. And it was so funny because I was like, hey, I want you to talk to my writer. And Janine is a black lady who speaks really well. And when she started to speak, they was like, we ain't telling the story to them. And I'm like, hey, she's cool. She's not the police. So we tracked down everybody. Oh, my God. Everybody that was still alive.
God. And then, you've been on the Marc Maron podcast, WTF. I heard that interview a while back, and that podcast always intrigues me. It's probably the most popular interview podcast in the nation right now. So you're sitting in his garage telling him these stories. What's he like as an interviewer to just pull these things out of you?
He was so cool. I had never heard of Marc Maron before I started that podcast tour. And, for him to... He really was passionate. He really understood that, we were from totally two different walks of life. And I thank him all the time for giving me an opportunity to sit in his garage. Because I thought 6 months later, the president sat in his garage.
That's right. He was on a few months after you. All right. Well, this memoir is just fantastic. It was just one of these things that I couldn't put down. I read it in a night. The book is Rabbit, a memoir by Patricia Williams with her co-writer, Janine Amber. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. And it's in paperback, so you have no excuse for not picking it up because paperbacks are cheap now. It's from Day Street Publishing. Patricia, fantastic offering here. Thanks for sharing your story.
I just want to say to you before we go out,
Yes.
Can I say this? I just want people to know this is not a Black American story. This is an American story. This happens to women of all walks of life.
Very well said, and I agree, having read it, to I agree with that statement. Patricia Williams, fantastic. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run.